one of our girlfriends, our mutual friends and I were texting yesterday, and we both have taken a lot of comfort from this podcast because apparently like my minor screw-ups are not going to get me disbarred, and even some major screw-ups are probably not going to get me disbarred. So I'm disappointed that Larry is doing this, but also comforted that I don't really need to worry about minor mistakes.
I mean, we'll go back to the story in a minute, but I think it's so true. I think maybe in our very first episode, we joked, you know, never have imposter syndrome again. It's partially that, like, there are some real fuck ups out there. And at the same time, it's a lesson that if you are reasonably competent and if you are trying really hard to do the right thing as a lawyer, you're generally pretty okay. And not that bad of stuff's going to happen to you.
Welcome to Lawyers Behaving Badly. I'm Karen Delaney.
And I am Jennifer Judge.
How are you?
I'm still laughing from the things we were laughing about before we even started recording.
Can I just share, and I know I just asked you how you are, but can I just share, we were going to use some very fun sound effects in this episode, but now we decided we can't, and I'm so disappointed. And I'm not even sure that'll come through in the recording because of how far it's coming through my speakers. But I had a little clown honky horn, and now I'm just sad we're not going to get to use it.
We will. I'm sure we will find opportunities to use them as we go through these episodes. But I was also laughing at us because we were laughing. And then we both took a breath and we were both like, professional, professional. So, and then we started talking and then we started laughing.
Just stop laughing.
So those of y'all that wonder, we are actually like this in real life. Like, this is basically what all our conversations sound like.
This is pretty standard operating procedure. So let's try again. How are you? You've still got renovations going on, I guess.
We do, although the countertop is being installed today, and then hopefully tomorrow is like sink, which would be a great quality of life upgrade to not have to brush my teeth in like the kitchen or a different room. And then we should be hopefully done this week, which would be amazing. And then I can kind of get my bathroom stuff back together. So things, everybody's healthy. I say that as like I have an allergy coughing attack. But other than allergies, everyone's healthy. Everyone's good. Like, I'm terrified to say that out loud, but we're all good here.
Oh, same. Yeah, same. And that's kind of how it is over here, too. Like, everybody seems to be marginally to reasonably healthy. And I'm sure that's not going to last long.
No. I mean, that's just the state of our world these days. And also the state of having kids.
Yeah. Speaking of having kids, should we move on to our hot toppy?
Yes. I didn't even plan that segue, but let's talk about the state of having kids and sometimes how kids get sick.
You and I both tweeted about this. This has been the subject of quite a bit of discussion online this past week. We came across a job posting, and it is from a small law firm, and actually a woman-owned law firm. And it appears that all of the attorneys at the firm are women, and maybe all the legal assistants too. So it seems to be a woman-owned, all-woman law firm. And the job posting is titled Legal Assistant / Childcare.
I'm laughing. You were going to get it in there.
Which immediately caught our eye. The next thing that caught my eye is the salary listed directly below that is $14 to $24 an hour. And the job posting reads, "Welcome to XYZ Law Firm. We are a fast-growing family law firm. We are looking for a legal assistant to work directly with a designated attorney on clients' cases, as well as provide needed childcare for the attorney. You would be a good candidate if you love people and human dynamics, are detail-oriented, and have the ability to execute tasks without someone checking your work. This position requires you to be the one to track the details. If you are a big picture person, this isn't the right position for you. Like the excitement that comes from a growing litigation firm. Can work alone or with groups of people. Love spending time with younger children. If you enjoy being around active children, helping them develop and grow, this may be a perfect fit. There may be times when you'll be asked to assist in caring for the attorney's children while stepping away from your legal work. And then the job description is divided into legal assistant responsibilities and child care responsibilities. So on the legal assistant side, you are going to be assisting an attorney with caseload, drafting simple legal documents, communicating with clients, e-filing, preparing and submitting electronic exhibits, reviewing the docket and pleadings, setting client meetings, setting up files, redacting files, updating client questionnaires. And then for childcare responsibilities, you will provide customized and personalized childcare for four-year-old twins in their home during early school releases, school breaks, closures, and/or when the children are sick. Contribute to a safe, caring, nurturing, and stimulating environment in which the children thrive and develop. Transport the children to and from activities and school when needed. Be able to communicate with the attorney when emergencies arise and childcare is needed. Should be able to quickly commute to this town if needed. Be comfortable being around dogs in the children's home. Minimum qualifications include excellent written and verbal communication, associate's degree or higher, preferred coursework in legal areas, preferred experience in law, and past experience working with younger children. Please submit a video cover letter to be considered. There are no specific requirements of what could be included within your video. You are welcome to discuss your work experience, why you are applying with us, or even what you like to do with your spare time. Pay $14 to $24 an hour, and then there's a host of benefits. What was your reaction to this?
I read this twice when I came across it to make sure I didn't misread it the first time, because I have to say, I have never come across a legal assistant slash childcare position. And I really thought that never the twain shall meet. They just don't seem like skill sets that you often look for in a singular hire. In addition to that, I was a little surprised by the pay, given that the pay is below minimum wage in many major U.S. cities. This one is not in a city that requires that. It would be above minimum wage in the place where this is.
Well, let me tell you, so, and we should say that the owner of the law firm has since posted a TikTok where she's like, am I the asshole? And she clarified that the pay should have been listed as $20 to $24 an hour. Now, I will tell you where we are, $25 an hour might get you a babysitter. It might not, mm-hmm. quite honestly. And if yeah. you're looking for somebody who is going to be available on demand and apparently working a full-time job otherwise, I don't think $25 an hour is going to cut it. But yes, no, when I first saw the $14, I was like, I would never pay somebody $14 to watch my children. That's not enough. And twins, four-year-old twins.
Four-year-old twins. And also, you've pointed this out, not only is it childcare, it's childcare when the children expressly are sick. Yeah.
That, go ahead, yes.
Yeah, you would be de facto, like as a point of the job, your job is to go when these children are too sick to go to school and exposing yourself, like we said, to the host of myriad viruses and infections that children harbor. I mean, they're little petri dishes. And so you're going to get every single, yes.
Half of this podcast has been you and I talking about our kids constantly being sick and making everybody in the house sick. Yes. And I think, so there were a handful of things that got me about this. Number one, the pay. And also, they're clearly not looking for a full-time nanny, but I remember I looked for a nanny in the Dallas area in 2019, and I was told base pay is $50 an hour, like bare minimum is $50 mm-hmm. an hour for a full-time nanny. Number two, I'm sure there are probably some very rich, terrible people who expect their nannies to come work with sick kids. But everybody else I know, basically when your kids are sick, the nanny gets a paid day off because you're not going to expose your only childcare to your sick children.
Yeah, that's, yeah, exactly. When the kids are sick, you get to stay home with them. And that's how everybody in the family gets sick. But you don't expose your nanny because then when she's sick, everybody else is healthy and you've got no one to watch your kids.
So you do not expect your child care to come care for your sick kids. You do not expect your babysitter to come and watch your kids when they are sick. And the fact that this firm offers PTO, okay, well, I guess you're going to need all of it because you are going to be getting sick on the job as a result of your exposure through the course of your job duties to all sorts of illnesses.
Well, and you certainly can't use it on holidays because that's when the kids are out of school anyway. So you would be expected to perform your job duties watching kids on all major school holidays as well.
So what, yeah, what holidays do you get? Apparently none. Shall we talk about the video cover letter?
Yes. I had a lot of favorite parts of this. That may have been the part that kind of put it over the top for me. And this is speaking from my experience as both an HR professional and a labor and employment attorney. I cannot see a legitimate reason for needing a video cover letter that would outweigh the litany of risks that it would create for you. There's no reason to need a video cover letter. You will interview these people. You don't need to have a video cover letter for them unless you're using it as a screening device before they even get in the door.
Right. It's like, tell me exactly what qualities you're trying to screen for via video that yes. you couldn't also probably get just through a simple phone call. I mean, if somebody is able to be warm and friendly on video, they can probably be warm and friendly via phone. The other thing that's really fascinating to me is this firm currently has another job posting available on LinkedIn. And there is no requirement for a cover letter, let alone a video cover letter. So that was odd.
Do you want to discuss more in depth the TikTok the firm owner made and kind of her reasons for posting this job description and wondering whether she's the asshole for doing it?
Yes. And I think that TikTok was made in direct response to your tweet and a number of the replies that you got. So I think a handful of people accused her of sexism. To me, this doesn't really read as sexist.
No. And I think the only reason they said that is probably because of the video cover letter and you're screening for, I think they assumed it was a male law firm and they were screening for some attractive young women. But as we discussed, it's not a female law firm. So I can see how you would jump to that conclusion, but I didn't read anything sexist in this. I read a lot of other things, but not anything sexist.
So yes, she wondered, am I the asshole here? This is the first time I've dealt with bad PR, because she's, I think, authored a couple of books. She has a podcast. She, it seems like, has put a lot of thought into how to develop a modern law firm that is friendly to women and working women. And she named the specific attorney at the firm who has two kids and is frequently unavailable because of her kids being either out of school or sick. I mean, I hope that was done with the consent of that attorney and that that attorney feels very comfortable with that piece of business being out there, because I was honestly quite shocked.
I kind of cringed when I heard that.
I was shocked that she named the individual. And then it was obviously very well-intentioned. She said, look, she's away from work a lot because of her childcare issues and I'm trying to help her. And I think you and I both had the same response, which was, well, you could do that by simply paying her more so that she can afford additional childcare that she needs. But also, this is simply the reality of being a working parent in the United States. I mean, my school district, my kids, my oldest is the only one who's in public school. My other is in daycare because he's too young. But every month, there are at least 2 days that the kids are out of school every single month during the school year. That doesn't account for spring break or winter break, and it does not account for the days that they are sick. And the simple fact is that if you have either a single parent or two working parents, and you have a child who is of school age, you are simply going to be unavailable to work. That is just the reality of working life. It is. Yeah. And it is extremely difficult to find childcare now. Daycares across the country, I mean, the pandemic forced the closure of a number of daycares across the country. It's also a very expensive endeavor, and quite a few people cannot even afford daycare. And I know like we're kind of probably mid-range price, but when both my kids were in daycare, I think we were spending close to $40,000 a year just on childcare, right? And then it is also extremely difficult to find somebody who can pinch hit on school holidays, because most everybody who is on care.com or looking for a childcare job is looking for regular employment, whether that's regular part-time employment or regular full-time employment. They're not looking just to be your on-call babysitter for the few days every month that the kids are out of school because of school holidays. And nobody wants to watch your sick kids and expose themselves to illness. Nobody wants to do that unless they're in some sort of skilled nursing, like a skilled nursing profession where their job is to care for ill patients. But that's not what this is. This is just, let's free up mom to work while little Timmy is at home with the flu or whatever.
Yeah, that was you and I, you're right. You and I had the exact same reactions to that. And it's, you can do what every, when employers care about this for their employees, what they do is they find subsidized licensed childcare for them for emergency situations, or they pay them more so that they can afford it, or they give them more time off or give them schedule flexibility so that they can change their schedule such that they can stay home with sick kids. Like, those are the options.
I mean, my thought was, because I they're not big enough, I think, to afford, you know, some sort of...
No, they don't have like Bright Horizons, like big firms.
To be able to afford that. So my thought was, give her more paid time off and just understand that this is, if you want to hire and develop and support and retain working parents, this is simply the reality that we need to accommodate.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that doesn't even go into one thing I was thinking about last night. Like, we're not going to say what state they're in or city or anything, but I'm going to assume if you are a business who is providing employees who provide professional childcare to children, there's some sort of licensing requirements, background check requirements, like not the whole host of administrative requirements that you may have to meet that you unintentionally walk into if you're hiring someone simply to provide childcare on a part-time basis.
The other thought that I had from the employee perspective is, I would never want to invite my employer into my relationship with my childcare provider.
No, not at all.
I want the flexibility and autonomy to manage that relationship myself. The other thing is, so if I leave my job, I'm going to lose my childcare.
Yeah. It makes you beholden as the working parent to that. And then say you're uncomfortable with them providing childcare. Does that mean you have to give them a PIP and they have 30 days to improve their performance?
Right.
Like, who wants that when you, right. you know, something happens with access to your children? And then on the flip side, from the perspective of the person they're hiring, how do you manage performance with someone when you have such a wide range of job duties and responsibilities? It seems like a minefield of issues that, I mean, I think there's a reason large companies don't do this, because it's impossible to manage someone like this or appropriately administer this job duty or role.
Yeah. And I think the simpler solution is, again, give your employee more paid time off, because you're mm-hmm. already taking, presumably the attorney's rate is significantly higher than what they're going to pay this legal assistant, but you are contributing both hourly wages and benefits to this assistant. Take a chunk of that change and give it to your attorney as a child care benefit. Increase her pay to create coverage for this. Or again, just accept that if you say you want to support women and working parents in the workplace, this is the reality of having young kids. It just is.
Yeah, it is. Until there is something, I mean, this is, welcome to capitalism. This is what it is when there's no backstop. And this is what small businesses, obviously it hits them harder than larger companies when one person has a much larger swing at it. But this is what it is. And these are the options to fix it. And I don't think we can try to be creative, but this one sure seems like it introduces more, way more issues than it purports to solve.
Yeah, I also would be going back to the employee-employer relationship. Maybe I'm just the weirdo. I would feel so deeply uncomfortable with my babysitter being at the office, talking to my boss. Like, I want some sort of boundaries and privacy. And I think I would worry that those boundaries might be violated by the fact that my childcare provider reports to my boss. And it's not necessarily that I'm not going to be honest with my supervisor. I mean, of course, I'm going to be honest with my supervisor, but I also feel like I should be the one to make the decisions about what information to share and what information is appropriate to share, and not necessarily introduce somebody else in the mix. Because, for example, it seems like this person is, this position has been created because the owner of the law firm perceives it as a problem that this attorney mm-hmm. is unavailable so frequently. And there are times when my husband and I disagree on whether one of our kids is really sick enough to stay, to need to stay home. And mm-hmm. I can sort of imagine a situation where this legal assistant slash babysitter comes into the office and starts running her mouth about, oh, well, he wasn't actually like really sick and I just stayed home with him and he seemed totally fine. And that introduces questions about, is the attorney, is her judgment accurate about whether her child needs to stay home? Is she just kind of like trying to get out of the office or whatever? And I don't want to have those conversations with my supervisor. All you need to know is that I believe my child needs to stay home.
Yeah. And that's funny because the same thing I thought of was, is this employee now going to be exposed to, I mean, you know, and every working couple of parents know, you know, when a kid wakes up in the morning and is sick, or when they're in the middle of the night, they come down and they're sick. The first thing you do with your spouse or your partner is compare schedules for the next mm-hmm. day and be like, well, I've got meetings from X to X and I have to be in the office, or I've got this and I can waive that or I can postpone that. And you get into this negotiation. And what happens if that employee either overhears it or thinks, you know, oh, well, she could have stayed, she could have gone to the office because the husband was doing this or this. So same thing, you're introducing an element that I don't want my boss ever being privy to, or ever judging me on these intensely personal decisions that we make as our family. And then on the flip side, again, as the employee who's hired to do this, I would just be absolutely weirded out by providing childcare to my supervisor for my job. I mean, I am a legal assistant and they're giving me feedback and we're working on that. But at the same time, I'm in their home. I'm providing this intensely personal service to her and her children. It would be extremely awkward and uncomfortable. Maybe I'm weird and maybe other people think that's great, but I'd rather, as I say on TikTok, sit naked on a hot grill than do that.
I think also people are legal assistants because they don't want to do childcare. Again, childcare is very difficult to come by in this country right now. It is in high demand. I know the daycares that my kids have been through have always been looking for qualified mm-hmm. personnel. And, you know, I've also unfortunately had the experience with a daycare where we hired a new teacher and her previous job was at like Burger King. And mm-hmm. it was, you know, a step up for her to move from fast food to childcare. And then she got fired for hitting my son, but that's a story for another day. I also just am skeptical that you're going to find somebody who has these skills that you would want as a legal assistant, who's also like, oh yeah, I want to go take care of 2 4-year-olds for $25 an hour who are potentially sick with a contagious transmissible disease.
The job description is like, have you ever had hand, foot, and mouth? Do you want to? What about
foot disease? Have you ever experienced getting COVID, the flu, and strep all in 1 3-week period? Well, now you can.
What about pink eye and ear infections?
How do you feel about lice in the workplace?
You will definitely be exposed to a bevy of unique and transmissible viruses and diseases. And if you want to booster up that immune system naturally, this is the job for you.
I guess. I think it it seems to have come from a place of good intentions. I honestly was just shocked that this was a woman-owned, all-woman firm. Like, I saw this, I was like, oh, God, like, what guy wrote this? And then I Googled it. It was like, what?
Yes.
Same. What? And this law firm owner has spoken extensively before about modernizing her law firm and not chaining people to their desks. And you can work from home. You can work from the office. I support women. I knew I always wanted to be a law firm owner and trailblaze and all that kind of stuff. And I think she probably perceives this as part of the trailblazing. And I just think there's probably, if you really want to put your money where your mouth is, there's another place to put it.
Without exposing some random legal assistant to viruses and these issues and essentially trying to pay her $20, $25 an hour for a job that it's two full-time jobs that demand substantially more than that.
For twins. Twins.
If you can find babysitters for $25 an hour for four-year-old twins, like, more power to you.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's intriguing. And I am very interested to know if she manages to hire somebody for this position and how it works out. I also would really like to hear from the attorney herself for whom this position was ostensibly created. She's been named in the TikTok, so I would be very interested to hear her perspective on why she thinks this is a good idea. And has she really thought through whether she's comfortable with this? Or was this something where, I mean, this is your boss being like, oh, I'm just going to hire a legal assistant slash child care provider to you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are you just kind of like, oh, okay. And maybe you just let it ride because, maybe you just let it ride because you're like, she's never going to find somebody. Like, I don't really need to worry about this. It's not going to come to fruition. I'll just let this one kind of like peter itself out.
I'm imagining coming home to my husband and being like, good news, our childcare woes are solved. My employee, my new employee is going to watch our kids. And my husband would be like, what the fuck?
She's great at filing pleadings and turning on Bluey. So,
yeah, exactly. She can snot what knows Frida and she can calendar deadlines.
With the best of them.
Yes.
Well, all right. Best of luck to them. We'll keep an eye on that because, again, I am very interested to see if and how this pans out. So I hope the law firm owner will update her TikTok on that one. What are we talking about this week? So I know a whole bunch of people flagged us. They flagged this bankruptcy case for both of us, and you took it, so I didn't read about it. I just know.
Okay, good. I was going to ask.
I won't spoil anything.
Yeah, I'm hoping that you had not read this because I saw this from a friend of ours that posted it on LinkedIn. And then a couple other people who practice in bankruptcy emailed it to me, I think like minutes after it was posted on LinkedIn. And then a bunch of people online also sent it. And it was just delightful. So as soon as I read it, I knew that it was just perfect for this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll caveat this, it's about bankruptcy. So unlike labor and employment issues or financial institutions, I basically have no experience with bankruptcy court or bankruptcy cases. I know the subject, I know litigation, but bankruptcy rules can be different in places and the same in places. And curious on your experience with bankruptcy.
Did you know I actually started out in the bankruptcy section of our law firm?
I did. So I remembered that, but I didn't know how long it was. And I didn't know if you got like amazing experience there or not.
I did not. It's why I moved to the litigation section. It was, I mean, you know, bankruptcy is so cyclical. And it wasn't even that I was super interested in bankruptcy. It's that during my clerkship as a summer associate, I split my time between the litigation group and bankruptcy. And the people that I got assigned to in litigation were, I think, largely unavailable because they had giant trial going on. And I just didn't get to know them very well or click with them. And I got to know the bankruptcy group much better. And so when it came time to choose where I was going, I was like, well, I guess I'd rather go to the bankruptcy group. But then bankruptcy is so cyclical that the first 6 months or so when I started, they had no work for me to do, just zero. And so I got hooked back up. I went to the people I had worked with in the litigation side and started working with them again. And then decided, you know, I think I really would prefer to be on the litigation side. I have a little bit of familiarity with it. And then throughout the years of my practice, sometimes bankruptcy issues come up, especially when you're dealing with potentially other businesses. So I have a little familiarity with it on that side, but I was never a bankruptcy practitioner, really.
Yeah, that's similar to my experience. I know enough to know bankruptcy is litigation in many aspects. So a lot of the litigation rules and aspects apply. And then, like you said, I know enough like with automatic stays and issues like that that may come up when you have other parties in litigation or in bankruptcy or vendors in bankruptcy. So I know enough to be dangerous, essentially, and to follow my way through this complaint to understand exactly what was going on. So let me introduce you to Larry Lawyer. We're going to use Larry Lawyer again this week. Honky honky from our clown horn. Here we go. So Larry Lawyer is a solo. He runs Larry Lawyer PC. I pulled him up on Avvo, and his avatar was the Buddy Christ picture from Dogma, with the Christ going like, hey. So
I don't even know. I'm going to have to Google that. I don't even know what that is.
I can send you a screenshot too.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh.
So.
All right.
He's not your normal lawyer. He's a cool lawyer.
He's a cool lawyer. What an intriguing choice.
I tried to pull up his website, but this was after everything had gone down. And so the front page of his website just says the site is undergoing changes with a background picture. So he's on it in terms of the issues that were raised as a result of this. So what we have here is a court opinion. And that's where most of this information came from. It was an opinion and order by a bankruptcy judge against this lawyer. But it goes through a whole host of issues. So Larry is a bankruptcy lawyer, and he represents individuals and small companies who file bankruptcy and helps them through their bankruptcy cases. So our story begins in October 2020. Jane and John clients reach out to Larry about him representing them in a potential bankruptcy that they need to file. So they meet and discuss their case with Larry in late 2020. Larry tells them that because they're expecting a large tax refund, they should wait until they receive it to file their bankruptcy case. Basically, get that money in your pocket before you file your bankruptcy case, because if you file it before you receive your tax refund, it's going straight to the creditors, essentially. And if you're unfamiliar, once you file bankruptcy, the creditors, your creditors, basically have to get in line behind you in order of priority. And any money that you have or that you receive gets divvied out to them in order of that priority. And so when you file bankruptcy, your creditors basically have to get in line in order of priority. And any money that you, the debtor, receive means that it goes to those creditors in line in order of that priority. They were waiting essentially to put that money in their pockets so that they have it before they filed, so that it wouldn't go straight to any creditors that they may have.
Which seems weird to me, because it's still going to
it's go still going to go to them one way or the other.
And yeah, in personal bankruptcy, there's all sorts of rules about how much of your assets people can take, and do you have to sell your house, and what amount of house can you retain, all that kind of stuff. But I mean, it's not like you're just going to be footloose and fancy free with your tax refund and able to shield it from your creditors. So I'm already perplexed. Continue.
Yeah, at first pass, it's kind of like, oh, okay, I understand like why he would give that advice. But like you said, on the other hand, it's not like you get to like go to Vegas with that money and not use it. So it's
right. Bad things happen if you file bankruptcy and then go spend all of your money. Courts don't like that.
Another thing about bankruptcy filings is that you, as the person requesting bankruptcy, are swearing under oath that the answers you provide in your bankruptcy filing are accurate. And just like you said, at the time you file, you have to disclose any cash you have, you know, bank accounts, paychecks you've received for the certain time period before you filed bankruptcy, assets, things like that. And if what you file is inaccurate or the court believes you're lying, they can dismiss the bankruptcy action and you don't get the relief you were looking for. Basically, your creditors can still come after you and you don't get your discharge of debt. Jane and John listen to Larry's advice, and they wait and receive their tax refund and then work with Larry to prepare their bankruptcy filing. He sends them a draft, asks them to review it, and adds a separate attachment of just signature pages, basically saying, you know, here's the draft, and then send me your signatures on these signature pages. Even though Larry sent those documents with that information to John and Jane, he never met with them beforehand to actually discuss what they had in their bank accounts, what assets they had, or anything like that.
Oh, that seems bad. That seems like malpractice.
Yeah, and because the first thing that you have to disclose in your bankruptcy filing is what's in your bank account, what assets you have, and things
every
like that.
Every single asset you have and the value of all your assets, every single debt you have and the amount of those debts. Kind of seems like you're not going to be able to swear to that stuff under oath if your lawyer never bothers finding out what they are. He's just like, I don't know, you probably have a house.
My story, KP.
Sorry. I can already say, I'm like, what? This is not how things are done. You know what? Okay, this is a total diversion from your story, and I'm sorry, but one of our girlfriends, our mutual friends, and I were texting yesterday, and we both have taken a lot of comfort from this podcast because apparently, like, my minor screw-ups are not going to get me disbarred, and even some major screw-ups are probably not going to get me disbarred. So I'm disappointed that Larry is doing this, but also comforted that I don't really need to worry about minor mistakes.
I mean, we'll go back to the story in a minute, but I think it's so true. I think maybe in our very first episode, we joked, you know, never have imposter syndrome again. It's partially that, like, there are some real fuck ups out there. And at the same time, it's a lesson that if you are reasonably competent and if you are trying really hard to do the right thing as a lawyer, you're generally pretty okay. And not that bad of stuff's going to happen to you.
Also, if you read the rules and follow them, you might probably be okay.
Yeah, exactly. And have enough good friends. And this is kind of another lesson. Have enough good friends to call you on your bullshit when you're really fucking up. And you should be okay. Unfortunately for Larry, he didn't have those people because in the disclosure regarding John and Jane's bank accounts, Larry listed that their balance was zero in all bank accounts. John sends an email to Larry letting him know that that's inaccurate and that their checking account balance as of that day was roughly $5,500 and that they didn't have a savings account. Larry receives this email and updates the schedule, but somehow lists that John and Jane have a checking account amount of $2,000 and a savings account amount of $1,700. And so he made that change, which does not reflect at all what John told him, and then never sent a new version to John and Jane to review with the new amounts in it.
But he's already got their signature pages.
He does. On April 16th, Larry files the bankruptcy filing with the electronic signatures from his clients. He also filed an application to pay the roughly $400 filing fee in installments, saying that his clients were unable to pay the filing fee in one payment. And that also required a sworn signature from his clients that they could not afford that and needed to pay in installments. As you guessed, especially when I mentioned dates, Jane and John didn't send their signed copies of the petition with their signatures to Larry until April 20th, which was 4 days after he filed this. And so they said, here are the signed papers. Sorry we took a few extra days. We wanted to read over everything again. Larry never tells John and Jane that he'd already filed the petition and did so without them signing it. And John and Jane never knew that Larry filed the filing fee application without them signing it.
Mm-hmm.
Thoughts on this client management?
This all seems real bad.
Yeah. So we're starting out with a bang.
Yeah, this is, I mean, go big or go home, I guess.
Both the judge and the trustee who was appointed to represent the creditors, and we'll get to the trustee in just a minute, both note that on the day the filing was due and Larry filed the application, and Larry filed that the debtors had no ability to pay the $400 filing fee, Jane and John did have roughly $5,500 in their checking account. And so they're like, no, they could have afforded it.
Yikes.
So I mentioned the trustee. When you file a bankruptcy case, the court appoints someone as trustee, and that person's responsibility is to represent the creditors and basically discover information, do what they can to accumulate enough money to pay off as much as possible of the debts that you have as someone filing bankruptcy. As soon as the case was filed, the trustee was appointed, and quickly after that happened, Larry told Jane and John that they needed to get their bankruptcy case dismissed because the person who was appointed as trustee was, quote, greedy, corrupt, and would make their life hell and would make the clients sell their house.
Hmm.
And so Larry planned to engineer exactly that. And this is what results is his grand plan appeared to be to get the bankruptcy case dismissed so that his clients could refile and basically play trustee roulette to try and get a new trustee.
This all seems very bad.
The court granted Jane and John's application to pay the filing fee in installments. A few days after that order was issued, Jane and John pay the first $125 installment. Larry then emails clients and tells them he would invoice them for the second payment, but they shouldn't pay it. And specifically, he told them, quote, "There are three court fee invoices, but don't pay these. We need to get the case dismissed, and not paying the court fee is the fastest way to get there."
What? What? Number one, it's a filing fee, and you have already filed. You owe the fee. It doesn't, like, you can't unfile and be like, JK, JK.
That's what I was just about to say. Do you see any flaw in this great plan of Larry's?
And it also sounds like what he's saying is just don't pay the fee and the court will enter sanctions against you by dismissing your case.
Yeah. And that's the next part is having your case dismissed through a willful failure to comply, which is what this is.
Yes.
With the ordered installment payments can result in you being prevented from filing another bankruptcy case for at least 6 months or completely.
Oh, my God. Wow. I'm starting to think this guy might not be the best lawyer.
Oh, just wait. He's clever. On May 17th, the trustee scheduled an initial creditors meeting with Jane and John. And that's basically where representatives from the creditors and the debtors get together and discuss essentially divvying up the money and their approach to that. Larry, being a creative problem solver and very entrepreneurial, told his clients not to show up to the creditors meeting.
Oh, my God.
A week before the creditors' meeting, Larry's assistant texted Jane and John and asked them to send certain documents for the meeting. Jane texted back saying, "I thought Larry said to let the meeting lapse and we would refile the bankruptcy. Do we still need to send docs now for that to happen?"
Mm-hmm.
On the day of the meeting, unsurprisingly, Jane and John were not there. Larry told the trustee that he had been unable to reach his clients, that he had called them and messaged them and had told them to show up, but they were unavailable and he couldn't get in contact with them.
Oh.
On the record, he described how he tried to reach them by phone and another method, but he had not heard from them and had to assume that they wouldn't be there. With Jane and John not there, the trustee cancels the meeting and reschedules it for another time several months later. As you might expect what happens next, Larry texts his clients and tells them not to appear at the rescheduled creditors meeting as well.
Oh my God.
It's handy, again, that these people are putting all their schemes in writing, which is another takeaway from this podcast. Stop putting your schemes in writing.
And it looks like we got all these
communications. Yes. And it looks like we got all these communications, by the way, from the resulting malpractice lawsuit that Jane and John filed against Larry.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Larry, in the text to his client, said, "We're trying to get this current case dismissed, so don't attend the next hearing. Don't worry about any documents either for right now, since we need to update those in the next case we file anyway."
Well, it's so like, it's don't worry about the documents because you may never be able to file them at this rate. So,
you may be shocked to hear this. At the rescheduled creditors meeting, Jane, John, and Larry don't appear.
Okay.
Around the same time as the creditors meeting, the trustee filed a notice of possible dividends, which is essentially a notice that there may be money that the debtors have that should be used to pay the creditors. And the trustee was referring to pay stubs for both Jane and John that they would have received prior to filing their bankruptcy filing. Mm-hmm. Larry saw this and texted his clients and told them, "Our buddy, the trustee, is up to his old tricks and has filed a report of possible dividends. It prevents our case from being dismissed over the non-payment of court filing fees. Clever. But I'm clever too. Since we held the case for a while before we filed it, the pay stubs we filed are out of date, and as a result, we didn't comply with a mandatory requirement. And when I point that out, the court will have to dismiss the case by statute."
Oh, I feel like this is not going to work.
There's one thing I've learned in litigation is that normally you can't shoot yourself in the foot and then say, "I shot myself in the foot. Please grant me the relief I'm seeking and dismiss this without prejudice."
Right. I feel like a federal bankruptcy judge is not going to be very sympathetic to this.
No, not at all. Soon after, Larry files the debtor's first motion to dismiss their case, asserting that their case should be dismissed because Jane and John had not filed pay stubs that were required under the bankruptcy law when they had first filed the lawsuit. Larry's motion stated that John's final pay stub was April 2nd and Jane's final pay stub was April 16th. What Larry didn't mention is that he had pay stubs that they were required to be filed that he claimed were missing. They were in his possession before he ever filed the original bankruptcy petition. Larry had even filed them in that case for a different purpose, so they were actually in the court's record, and he couldn't argue that he didn't have them.
I guess I'm confused as to why he thinks this gets the case dismissed, even if it's a mandatory filing requirement. This is fixable. You just file them unless what's actually going on is that this is considered some sort of like fraud on the court by failing to file that stuff. And so your case is terminated as a result, or, you know, you lose the protections of bankruptcy because the court determines that you've essentially tried to defraud your creditors and the trustee and the court itself. I don't really understand why Larry thinks that this is some sort of silver bullet that's going to get them out footloose and fancy free.
It feels like more than too clever by half. Like he thinks this grand scheme is going to work and no one will figure out what exactly he's doing.
It feels like Larry is not very smart and not very good at his job. Yes. What it feels like.
So earlier in the case, like we said, Larry had filed John's pay stubs from April 9th and April 16th, which were two additional from what he said existed in his motion to dismiss. Despite that, Larry kept telling his clients we're going to be okay and that the court would have to dismiss the case by statute. And Larry followed up just to let them know and say, I pored over the statute to look for any loopholes that they could exploit to keep this case open, and I don't believe there are any, so I am confident that your case will be dismissed.
Ugh.
Assume you're the trustee and you're standing in his shoes and you see this motion to dismiss come rolling in. What is your response?
I'm going to steamroll you. I want discovery. I want to know how this happened. I mean, part of it is probably just how much money is the trustee getting paid and where is that money coming from? But like, is there money in the estate to actually pay the trustee to do all this stuff? But I mean, I want to know why we're just learning about this stuff now. And I'm going to dig, I'm going to unturn every single stone to find additional assets for the creditors.
You would be a good trustee in this case because that's basically exactly what they do. he files a response to the motion to motion to dismiss, pointing out that you're claiming these pay stubs don't exist and it must be dismissed by statute, but the pay stubs actually do exist and you've already filed them and they're in the court's record and here's the docket numbers where they can be found. Unsurprisingly, the trustee also finds a case that says debtors are prohibited from using the omission of their own documents and pay stubs to obtain dismissal of their bankruptcy case.
Yeah, that makes sense. You don't get to get something good out of screwing up on purpose.
It brings up something that I think we come across a lot as lawyers, too, in giving advice when a client comes to you with like this really creative scheme and they want you to give advice on it. And they're like, this is going to solve a problem that no one's ever thought of. And it turns out that everyone has thought of this and they've already said you can't do it. And there's a lot of times where you have to think to yourself, if this were such an easy solution, why hasn't everyone done it already? And the answer is,
yeah,
they haven't. It's not allowed.
It's illegal. That's why.
Yeah. Larry is committed to the bit. Larry forces the court to hold a hearing on his motion to dismiss. And the trustee's complaint had transcripts of this hearing. And just tell me your first reaction if a hearing starts out with the judge asking you, let me ask you, Larry Lawyer, factually, is your motion to dismiss correct?
I'm immediately shitting my pants.
Yeah. That's what we call in the business a shot across the bow. Like, you know how this hearing is.
IDK, Your Honor.
You tell me.
Yeah, I don't know. What is that, like a thing?
Larry says, of course it's accurate. And the judge immediately points out the missing pay stubs. And Larry concedes that his motion is, quote, false regarding the missing pay stubs. The judge then points out the docket number of the filing where all the missing pay stubs are located. And he follows up with, okay, and you didn't even bother looking, even though the trustee had raised this exact point in the objections.
This is not going well.
No. Larry concedes that it was, quote, his mistake that he missed it. And the judge tells him, I'll just quote from the judge, it's very disconcerting to me to see you making a representation like this. This is a very important issue. It's the only basis for your motion to dismiss. I actually identified your problem in maybe 10 seconds before ever reading the trustee's objection. I want to suggest to you, you need to be much more careful when you're presenting materials in federal court, sir.
That is actually a very measured and kind response.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. At the same time,
I would be shitting myself
terrifying.
Yet again.
Yes.
Yeah, no, yeah. Yeah.
I can't comprehend of a situation in which I would be in Larry's shoes, but at the same time, I can't even, like we joked about being in a fugue state in the last episode, I would go into that fugue state. Like, I would black out if a judge was telling me that and I had done something like this.
I would be like, Your Honor, BRB, can we take a bio break? And then I would get in my car and drive away and never come back.
Just drive south and not come back.
It's like, I'm going to find a beach in Mexico, and if you can find me, then I guess we'll talk again. Goodbye.
Larry goes back and texts his clients and asks them to send him all their pay stubs again. And he explains, quote, I fucked up something at the hearing. I filed the motion to dismiss your case based on the 416 pay stub not being available, but in fact it was. So the judge yelled at me and refused to dismiss your case. That said, you are missing earlier pay stubs, so I'm going to file a motion to reconsider or a new motion to dismiss.
This does not seem like a well-thought-out plan.
No. He's committed. He files a second motion to dismiss for missing pay stubs for Jane client from February 26, March 5th, and March 19th. But what Larry doesn't mention is the pay stubs are missing because Jane didn't work those periods and the pay stubs don't exist. Jane was kind of an hourly worker and paid as she showed up. And so she didn't work and didn't have any of those pay stubs.
Wait, so he's like, you have to dismiss my whole case because my client has not presented her pay stubs from these dates. And like, they don't exist.
Yes, that's exactly right.
This seems like a bad plan.
In her initial email sending over her pay stubs, Jane had told Larry explicitly, and this was before he ever filed the bankruptcy petition, he had told him explicitly, I don't have pay stubs for those times because I didn't work. And then she again texted Larry and said, there are weeks I don't have paychecks because I had COVID that month and couldn't work.
Mm-hmm.
We don't get a satisfying resolution to the second motion to dismiss because Larry's other shenanigans derailed the case before that.
Oh, go on.
Now we talk about discovery. Similar to a civil lawsuit, the trustee is allowed to engage in discovery and obtain documents from the debtors in a bankruptcy case. Multiple times, the trustee reached out to Larry about those documents in April and then basically through April into late May. Larry never told his clients that the trustee had made document requests and didn't ever respond to the document request, which is not how it works. This is
literally not how it works.
It's not how it works.
This will also get you in very big trouble with a federal judge.
Very quickly, yes. Especially because Larry had many of the documents that the trustee requested in his possession from John and Jane, and he just never produced them.
Mm-hmm.
He told his clients, we're trying to get the current case dismissed, so don't attend a hearing, and don't worry about sending me any additional documents.
Okay.
Like in civil litigation, the trustee filed the motion to compel production of this information from John and Jane, basically telling the court, can you please force them to give me these documents that I'm entitled to look at? KP, you're Larry. What do you do in response to a motion to compel?
Well, given Larry's previous track record, I think I'm just going to take some bullshit and slap it on a page and file it with the court. And I'm just going to roll the dice and see what happens here. Or I might throw my clients under the bus because he's done that too. So he might just be like, maybe he calls up the trustee and he's like, Number one, we're going to dismiss this case. Number two, my clients aren't giving me what I need, so sorry.
You and Larry are simpatico. Larry.
Don't
Larry,
say that. That's rude. That is so rude.
Your villain era is similar to Larry's, apparently.
Oh, that's the most depressing villain era ever.
Larry doesn't tell his clients about the motion to compel filed against them at all.
Yeah, of course.
And
of course.
Basically slaps together a bullshit response to the motion to compel that doesn't provide any legal or factual basis why it should be denied, and basically just goes on a rant about the trustee and why the trustee is a bad person in his response.
Oh,
unsurprisingly, that it's an approach. It's definitely an approach. The court sets another hearing about this. This is, by the way, you don't get this many hearings in court at all, and federal court especially. So this is a lot of hearings for a case.
If I were Larry, I would not want this level of attention on me.
Mm-mm. Larry didn't tell his clients that there was a hearing set on the motion to compel against them. And in fact, right before the hearing was about to start, texted them and told them no real developments in their case had occurred.
Oh.
Leads to the court ultimately granting the motion to compel, which included an order to turn over all the requested documents and their keys so that they could inspect their real property within 7 days. Larry does not tell his clients about the court order compelling them to do this and does
not. You know what is so okay? What keeps getting me about this? Number one, I'm going to assume that this is one of those guys who probably has like hundreds of cases. And so he's just committing malpractice all over the place because there's no way to manage that kind of docket. Like, that's the most generous interpretation of this. But the thing that's really killing me is that it would be so much easier and simpler to just follow the rules and provide the pay stubs that are required at the time they're required to be provided, provide the discovery that is requested, which he already has from his clients because they've given it to him. Like, there is a much simpler path here. And instead, at every chance, he's just like, no, I want to make this really hard on myself.
Well, that's because you don't know how evil this trustee is, KP. We need to get it dismissed.
Yes. Okay.
And the easiest way to get the court to grant the relief you requested is to refuse to engage in the discovery process, apparently.
Oh, my God.
So Larry doesn't tell his clients about the court order against him. And the trustee has to file a motion to enforce the court order, which then the court issues an order to the debtors to show cause as to why sanctions for civil contempt should not be imposed. And we've discussed orders to show cause before. They're the finding out portion after you've fucked around.
It's literally, if you're not a party to the lawsuit, and especially if you're not the one who's subject to the show cause order, it's like one of the most exciting things that happens because you're like, oh shit, somebody's about to get wrecked.
You're like, whatever's going to happen, there's going to be a judge yelling about it. That's what's going to happen.
I know. Get the popcorn.
At this point, Larry tells his clients that they need to send some information directly to the trustee via mail. Basically, I need you to mail some of these documents to the trustee. In his instruction email to his client, he says, if either of you have COVID or some other highly infectious, nasty disease, or if you know someone who does, please make sure they lick the envelope and handle it as much as possible before you send it.
See, that's a joke, I think. But that is not something you put in writing.
So that's funny because literally under it, I have highlighted one thing this case is a perfect example of jokes in writing always seem funny when you make them and seem a lot less funny when they're part of a court record.
They always fall so flat. And it's also why if you're representing a client who's getting deposed, one of my instructions is always there is no joking in this deposition. It's just because
it's no jokes.
What is likely going to happen at trial or in a motion that gets filed is your words are going to be written down. And in writing, your jokes are not going to be funny.
Yeah, especially sarcasm. Sarcasm does not convey in a transcript even a little bit. That does remind me, though, of my very favorite deposition story is a partner I worked for at one of my firms. Got into it with the, it was a woman, got into it with the male opposing counsel. And on the record, the male opposing counsel said, I'm sick and tired of this Hitler bitch, and stormed off. And that was funny to read in the depo transcript.
And can you just imagine the hearing on that one, Your Honor? Okay. My opposing counsel referred to me as a Hitler bitch.
I remember after it happened, we were like, what is a Hitler bitch? What could he have meant?
Oh my God.
They ultimately have another hearing on the order to show cause. Unsurprisingly, John and Jane, who were not there, are ordered to pay $2,800, basically trustees' fees that they incurred and all of this. But Larry helpfully tells the judge that a good part of the blame rested with him and that he'd pay the sanctions amount for his clients.
Yeah, you better. These are people who had $5,000 in their bank account.
Yeah, exactly. Can you pay half of your net worth to these people for things you never did?
Yeah, that's awful.
So here's where things get substantially worse for Larry.
Oh, Jesus. Okay.
The morning of the order to show cause hearing, Larry writes one of the individual creditors, one of the creditors that, you know, like we said, the creditors all kind of line up in priority, and the trustee and the creditors determine, and the judge as well, determine how the creditors are paid in terms of the money from the account. So when you file for bankruptcy as the debtor, you give up all right to negotiate directly with individual creditors. You're not allowed to do that. That's like, I don't practice bankruptcy and I know that. That's like bankruptcy right. 101. Larry emails one of the individual creditors and says, "Hi, Amy. I'm writing to request a bit of a favor. I've got an active Chapter 7 that has gone completely off the rails." And this is where he rants about the trustee, and he thinks he can get the case dismissed on statutory grounds. And should we fail, we'll be left in a protracted appeals process. We don't want to do that. In the event that we win, which I think we will, the creditor will receive nothing. But I'd prefer to see your client get paid, and I'd much prefer not to wait until mid-October to resolve those issues at trial. Instead, what I'd like is for you to request a copy of my client's tax returns, and we will willfully not comply with that request. In response, you will file a motion for dismissal of the case on statutory grounds. We will prepare a draft motion for your use, and in exchange for all of this, we will pay anything owed to you in full and compensate you for your time and cooperation in this process. Please let me know if this is of interest. Thoughts?
No, my brain just turned to jello. That's crazy. Colluding?
Yes.
With a creditor to get the case dismissed, fabricating disputes and motions, wasting the court's time, wasting the trustee's time, not to mention abusing the trust of your clients. I'm just sitting here with my mouth
you look stunned,
open. I don't have anything to say. Yeah, no, the gerbil fell completely off the wheel on this one. The wheel is spinning empty in my head at this point, and the gerbil's just laying on the ground gasping for air.
If you're the creditor who receives this email, what are you doing?
I'm forwarding it to the trustee and the judge. That's me. Now, this is an individual creditor. Like, it's not somebody who's represented by counsel.
No, it's not someone represented by counsel. But you're right. They immediately send it to the trustee. And basically, you're like, look at what this guy's trying to do. I mean, he offered to ghostwrite their motion to dismiss against his clients.
Yeah. And you have to wonder, this can't be the first time he's done this, right? I mean,
yeah.
You don't just come up with a harebrained scheme like this and try it out? Wow. Okay.
Assume you're Larry now and you realize this email was immediately forwarded to the trustee. What do you do?
Drive to Mexico?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, if I'm Larry, I'm obviously going to do some pretty bad stuff because I have continued to do bad things. Why stop now? But wow. Okay.
Well, Larry emails the creditor and tells them that first letter was, quote, privileged in nature and needs to be treated as a confidential settlement offer. And then you tell them that you're you tell them your intent was to be completely transparent.
Yeah, because settlement discussions are supposed to be confidential under the Texas and federal rules of evidence. So it's like, when I suggested that we commit a fraud upon the court, that was super confidential and you weren't supposed to tell anybody. It's like having a settlement discussion, like for a breach of contract, and being like, okay, I will pay you $400,000, but you have to help me rob this bank. And then getting mad when they call the cops.
When they're like, you guys want me to rob a bank? I'm going to tell everyone. Be like, uh-uh, you don't get to do that.
You can't do that. This is confidential. Haven't you read the federal rules of evidence?
It's like when people send a demand letter that's ridiculous, and then at the bottom they're like, copyright notice. Any reproduction of this demand letter violates my copyright. And it's like, uh-uh, it doesn't work that way.
I know, it's like the first thing I'm doing is putting that shit on Twitter. Good luck.
Yes. It turns out, shockingly, Larry did not tell his clients that he'd committed them to paying this creditor in full and that he was not authorized to make that settlement offer and never ran this, as you appropriately identified it, harebrained scheme by them. So they were completely in the dark.
These poor people, because can you imagine the amount of emotional and financial distress you have to be in to file personal bankruptcy? I mean, there are serious consequences to filing bankruptcy. And part of it is like the damage to your ego too. Like, I don't think anybody wants to file bankruptcy as an individual, you know, and there are implications for your credit down the road and all that kind of stuff. So to imagine the kind of distress that they are in for people who only have $5,000 in their bank account at the outset of this whole ridiculous thing, and somebody who's working hourly in a cage and obviously not getting paid when she doesn't work, and here this guy is like fucking around like this. I mean, it's just so disrespectful and displays such a lack of empathy for the position that your clients are in.
Absolutely. And I was going to say, it shows how little respect and regard you have for your clients and their actual livelihoods that you're playing these games like this.
Yeah. And the ability to get them through bankruptcy. And the whole point of bankruptcy is to kind of give you a clean slate to be able to start over. And so he's supposed to be shepherding them through this process to a place where they can begin again and move on with their lives. And instead, at every turn, he's just making things worse for them. So that's awful. I would support this guy being disbarred on this alone.
Well, it led to a sanctions hearing against him. And at that hearing, his clients attended. And this is where they find out all the information about him.
Oh my
about
God.
What
can
he's
you imagine
done.
Sitting in that hearing?
No, I can't. And they rightfully immediately fire him, basically, at the hearing. And then they, luckily, and the court is very clear to note this, go get set counsel who withdraws all the bullshit Larry has filed. And they eventually get their discharge and bankruptcy and they're done. So they are actually taken care of. And that's settled. Larry's problems are not over. The trustee files an adversary action against him personally and his law firm. And that is where I got most of the details about all of this, because it is about 200 pages long and has more than 100 exhibits. And it is all of the texts and emails and everything it sounds like he got as a result of the malpractice case that Jane and John rightfully filed against Larry. So Larry has this complaint filed against him. It's very comprehensive. Assume you're Larry, you're a seasoned litigator. What is your next step in the litigation that's now filed against you?
Well, I'm calling my malpractice carrier for one, assuming I have one, because Texas is one of the, we don't know, this is not in Texas, I don't think. Because as I say, in Texas, you are actually not required to have malpractice insurance. Yeah, I'm calling my malpractice carrier. Step one.
Are you representing yourself or are you getting counsel?
Hell yeah, I'm representing myself.
That's right. Larry represents himself. And he has a complaint filed against him. And he files a document called a response. Now, how often have you filed a response in response
to a
complaint?
I mean, that's not a thing. Because you're talking about an adversary proceeding. That's basically a lawsuit with it, like in the bankruptcy court, within the bankruptcy proceeding. It's a mini lawsuit. That's what it is. I think within bankruptcy, there are kind of like subspecialties of people who deal with adversary proceedings versus kind of the minutiae of bankruptcy itself. So, that doesn't give me a lot of confidence in Larry's abilities here to the extent that I had any to begin with.
The court in its order snarkily notes that a response is neither an answer nor a motion to dismiss that's permitted under the federal rules in response to a complaint. And that it, quote, seems to be an attempt to answer the complaint. So he files this and he says that he has, quote, been advised by counsel to avoid speaking in detail about the allegations in the complaint for fears that anything said could be used in whatever context for prosecution, whatever the merits, by the U.S. trustee. Actually, like, to some extent, somebody finally gave this guy some good advice, which was shut the fuck up. But then in his response, he says, we enter qualified admissions to every accusation in the complaint.
Wait, what? So he's like, you got that right. Every single thing you say I fucked up, I sure did.
He says they're qualified, but never actually says what qualifies them. And so the trustee files this, like, motion for more definite answer, which leads to another hearing. And the court is like, file a fucking answer. And he files another answer where he basically makes qualified admissions at every allegation in the complaint.
Okay.
He, at this point, he gives up the fight. He moves to withdraw his answer and have the court enter default judgment against him and his firm. And the court happily did that. But before the court could enter default, Larry filed a document claiming that he had, quote, adjustment disorder, and he shuts down when exposed to, quote, psychological trauma, like the adversary pleadings against him, and that he could not obey court orders that threaten his life, like this is happening now to him.
Okay. You can tell that to the bar disciplinary committee, friend.
Yeah. And the judge basically at this point is like, you say that, and yet you offered absolutely, like, not a doctor's note, nothing. You just told me that this is very threatening to you, and therefore you can't cooperate with this hearing and this adversary proceeding against you.
Also, you have a proven track record of being a terrible lawyer, so, and trying to defraud the court. I feel like this might be another little, might be another lie, might be another kind of like fraudy type scheme.
You've proven to be a lying liar who lies, and I don't know if I believe you in this one. So what do you think the court ultimately decided on for action against Larry?
Monetary sanctions and probably a referral to the bar, right?
They actually did more. He barred Larry and his law firm from practicing in bankruptcy court for 3 years. Yeah. The trustee had asked for 7. The judge compromised on 3 and basically said, I have absolutely no faith that you know what you're doing ethically or are familiar with the court's rules, and you need to spend these 3 years kind of getting right with God, and then you can reapply for admission to the bankruptcy bar.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
So that was the end of Larry Lawyer. They also, when I talked about his website being down, one of the orders was that he needed to immediately cease advertising himself as a bankruptcy lawyer. And so I assume that's why his website is under construction. Apparently, he had a lot of pending cases in the bankruptcy court, and the judge gave him basically a few days to immediately withdraw from those and find new counsel for his clients. So they definitely got a pound of flesh from this guy. And they gave, I think, appropriate sanctions for actions this bad.
Yeah, I still think he should be disbarred. I wonder if there are ongoing bar disciplinary proceedings against him, because this is all fairly recent. And I think one thing we've learned through doing this show is that the bar disciplinary process is ineffectively slow.
Extremely slow. Yeah, there's no twist on this one. Like, what if I told you he's been disbarred before, unfortunately?
So. God damn it. Sorry.
But that's the story of bankruptcy, Larry Lawyer. It was the order itself, and I tweeted it, I think, maybe last week, if you want to find it. It is quite a bench slap. Like, this is a judge that is fed the fuck up and done with it. And it's pretty searing in its language he uses for Larry, which is rare in my experience for a bankruptcy judge. And it is also, I think, 70 pages long. So it is long too. Like, this judge goes through everything. He was done. So it's a fun read if you want to make it sometime.
If if you just want to read 70 pages of an opinion.
Yes.
Wow. Well, I'm glad his clients figured out what was going on, even if they had to learn it at a hearing. And I'm sure that was a great shock to them and such a disappointment. And I hope this guy gets disbarred. But at the very least, I'm glad to hear that he's not going to be representing anybody in bankruptcy court anytime soon. I do worry that that leaves him able to represent people in non-bankruptcy cases.
Yes.
And there's no reason to believe that he'll be any good at that. So that's a problem. But better than nothing.
Better than nothing, I think. Do we want to tease what our next episode is? Do we even know what our next episode is? As I say this live
on the air. Sure don't. So I definitely don't want to tease it. Got a couple ideas in the hopper. We'll see.
Yeah, I've got a couple things percolating too. So we can discuss off air, but we will TBD on what our next episode is.
All right. Thanks. And again, leave us a review. We appreciate them all, and we read every single one. And you can always follow us on Twitter @BadLawyerPod. And thanks for tuning in.
Thanks, guys. See you next week.